the topic at hand. What is it that we are asking? Does science discredit faith? Do we mean that to say, does science disprove faith? Does it displace faith? Does it somehow trivialize faith? Now, there's a kind of ambient culture in many scientific communities which can be dismissive of faith, so I think it's helpful to make distinctions in order to better appreciate what is at stake and how best to hold fast what is good. So, to speak in kind of broad and sweeping way about 19th century developments that have brought us to the place where we are now, we can see that there is a kind of sense, downstream of Hegel and Marx and Auguste Comte, that religion or faith is a kind of primitive version of science. It's sentimental, it's naive, it's childish, it's hyper-dependent, contrary to the noblest aspirations of the human spirit, which are for a kind of unassailable autonomy. And rather, what we observe is a movement away from faith and towards science, a kind of inevitable progress, an inexorable evolution. You can think here of Marxist ideologies, which usually speak of an apocalyptic third age in which an underclass will come into possession of the goods of the earth, whatever those might be, and in so doing, usher in a kind of utopic period of general benevolence, right? So oftentimes, science or practitioners of science, philosophers of science, will seize upon this notion. And what we see, in effect, to kind of hearken to Hegelian themes, is that reason will be self-realized at that point, and in a certain sense, deified, okay? So that's the atmosphere in which we are often working, living, and breathing. So here, we're just going to make a very simple and modest claim, namely that science does not discredit faith if both are understood properly. So if practiced well, the disciplines do not genuinely conflict. And in fact, they investigate different things under different aspects or lights and with different methodologies. So they can in truth be complementary in their consideration or interrogation of reality. So I just have three small points. The first is an introductory notion about formal and material objects, which at this point might sound jargony, but will be clear in about 7 minutes. And then a brief philosophy of science, and then a yet briefer philosophy of faith with a short conclusion. I expect to speak for about 28 to 30 minutes, and if you have to leave at any point, feel free to do so. So, first, introductory consideration, material objects and formal objects. St. Thomas Aquinas, a Dominican friar of the 13th century, a great philosopher and theologian, wrote a work called Super Boethium De Trinitate, which is a commentary on Boethius' work on the Trinity. And in the fifth and sixth books of that, he describes the division and method of the sciences. And there, he's drawing distinctions about how we investigate certain dimensions of reality, which isn't just to say, like, integral parts, like some things study this thing over here on the left and some things study this here over on the right, but rather he's making a philosophical distinction, and he's employing abstraction, which we'll talk about here. So in the case, he says, of natural philosophy, what we do is we abstract from individual matter. So we cease to consider this flesh and these bones, and instead we consider flesh and bones. Then he says the next level of abstraction is practice in mathematics, and there we abstract from all sensible matter, okay? Basically all but quantity and figure, which for him is the fourth species of the accident quality, which is not terribly important at this stage, but I thought you might like to know. The third form of formal abstraction is when one abstracts from all matter, when one ceases to consider the object under consideration, except in light of most universal notions, namely under the aspect of being or unity or truth or goodness, for example. So abstraction, taken from the Latin abstrahere, just means to draw away from. And when one draws away from, we here have to introduce considerations of what it is that is seen and then how it is seen, because that is most pertinent and that's most helpful in our clarification of how it is that one practices a discipline. So the formal object of each of these sciences is conditioned by the manner in which abstraction is practiced. So he says, in natural philosophy, one considers ens mobile, which is to say mobile being. You consider matter under the aspect of movement or motion. And you can read in Aristotle's Physics, in Book 1, he basically starts phenomenologically. He starts with the observation that things out there move and seem to change. How do we account for that? That's just the beginning of the study. And fascinatingly enough, in St. Thomas's first way, among the famous five proofs for the existence of God, the first is taken from motion. And he begins with this I guess you would say, presupposition. He says, motion is evident to the senses. So St. Thomas starts close to his experience. And so too, he says, in the practicing of sciences. Next, with mathematics, we consider ens mathematica, which is to say number, form, and figure. So this is not being in the same sense as is under consideration in natural philosophy. And then with metaphysics, he says, we consider ens commune, or ens in quantum est ens. That is being insofar as it is being. So we're not considering this being or that being, but beingness in a kind of sense. So here, I think this is a nice introduction to consider the difference between material objects and formal objects. I said it sounds jargony, but it'll be clear here now in just about 2 minutes. So what is it that science does as we consider the physical sciences, principally, you know, biology, chemistry, and physics? Well, this roughly aligns with what St. Thomas and Aristotle would call natural philosophy. This is a hotly debated and controverted point as to how readily one can make this assertion, but I think that we can say that there is a kind of point of linkage here, and we can prosecute the discipline accordingly. So what we are considering in science is the world. This is, I mean, many scientists would argue that physics is the highest realization thereof, so you kind of start with that as a paradigm. So the world as mathematically quantifiable. So what is under consideration as your material object is basically what exercises force or what exerts force, okay? So what can be measured and quantified. Now, faith, and here, faith, strictly speaking, is not a science in the classic Aristotelian sense, but faith is the disposition that informs one's approach to theology and to a category which I will broadly call mysticism, okay? That's the ordinary practice of the faith. So the Christian belief being when one has the virtues of faith and charity, one lives relationally towards God and neighbor in a different way, all right? And that faith makes that possible because it gives access to realities which formerly would not have been readily available. So faith, in faith, whether theological, practiced in theology like a speculative science or practiced in mysticism, a kind of practical science, the material object is God and his mysteries, and then all things in light of God. So you can think about, you consider the world, but transfigured, all right? Or you consider the world, but in the way that Gerard Manley Hopkins does in the poem, you know, God's Grandeur. So you see it as somehow suffused with a God logic or a theologic. Now, that's the material object. That's the thing considered. What then about the formal object? Well, a formal object is the light under which one considers the thing at hand. So in what sense or in what way are we considering the material object? So science seeks inductive or probabilistic type of knowledge, right? So we're all familiar with the scientific method, right? You make a hypothesis after having gathered some data and you test it, and then you should be able to project, and you should be able to observe that Mars has an elliptical orbit if you're Kepler. You know, you should be able to see it played out by confirming signs, and you should have pretty strict normative standards for falsifiability. Right, you don't have standards for verifiability in the same sense because it's inductive, so there are always further determinations to be made. There is yet more matter to be explored. There are yet more test subjects, right, to be again, kind of entertained. So here, what we're dealing with is probabilistic, right, and it's hypothetical, but borne out, typically, by a normative standard of falsifiability. And oftentimes, whether we like to admit it or not, the ultimate test is usually supplied by use. Use in one way, shape, or form, whether that be enjoyment or health or technological progress, okay? So the way that science keeps chugging along as, you know, as if a boat beating on against the current is by proving itself as somehow useful, okay? This is not a denigration of science in any way. It's just to say that's how it plays out practically. Okay, now, the formal object of faith. The formal object of faith is, this will sound very bizarre and abstract, wild and woolly and unscientific, but bear with me, okay? The formal object of faith is first truth speaking. Right. That doesn't sound like a thing. That sounds like an unverifiable assertion. Bingo, okay. So the formal object of faith is first truth speaking, which is to say the reason that a Christian or the reason that a believer of any stripe believes is because someone has spoken. First, truth speaking. And the Christian claim is that truth himself is the one speaking. So then, one considers all things in light of that revelation is how it is ordinarily termed. So for instance, for a Christian to choose amongst doctrines is a kind of exercise in futility, because either God speaks truly or he doesn't. So St. Thomas will say, you know, he envisions the creed as a series of 14 propositions. He says, if I hold to 13 of the 14 propositions, but do not hold to the 14th, I don't actually hold any of those propositions by faith. Rather, I hold 13 of them by opinion because they accord with my sensibilities, and I reject the one on account of the fact that it does not. Because if I believe by faith, then I am actually putting my trust, a kind of fiduciary trust, in the one who reveals, and as a result of which I submit my intellect in a kind of steady disposition of belief. Okay, so that's our first consideration, material objects and formal objects. Simple, but it's just what are we considering and why, or under what light? So then given this, let's do a brief philosophy of science and then a philosophy of faith. So, a philosophy of science. Let's examine the philosophical tenets operative at the root of scientific praxis. So, a classical background and then a modern variation on the theme. So, science is taken from the Latin word scientia, which is taken from the verb scire, which just means to know. Okay, so science is a kind of knowing. And classically explained, it is a certain knowledge through causes. So it is a causal knowledge in which one can formulate a causal picture of the thing under consideration. So in Aristotle's estimation, science differs from doubt, differs from opinion, differs from suspicion. Because in doubt, one is suspended between two positions, neither of which garners assent. In opinion and suspicion, you hold to one, but for fear that the other proposition may obtain, you just don't have a sufficient data set, or you don't yet have terra firma on which to rest your feet. In the case, though, of science, you actually see the conclusions of the science through the principles. So a classic syllogism would be, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. What the conclusion that you have drawn is present in the premises, and what you're doing in the science is teasing that out. So it's demonstrative, okay? It admits of no, it brooks of no questioning in the way that inductive sciences do, okay? So, there's also classically a distinction drawn between speculative sciences and practical sciences. So, speculative science are just those sciences ordered to knowing. Okay, and we have small hints of this in the physical sciences. Sometimes people just, like, want to know what's in space because it's awesome, right? I want NASA to pay $40 billion for me to fly something through, like, jets emitted from the moons of Saturn because I suspect that I might be able to pick up, like, microbial excrement and thereby prove that there's life there. Will we ever be able to get there? Like, no, not a chance. Will it be, like, useful for our purposes of colonization? No way. But it's awesome.
Let's go.
Okay. So that a speculative science is the type of thing that is just worth knowing, as it were, and it may not even admit of further use, or if it does, that for you is a kind of secondary consideration. Then you have practical sciences, which are ordered towards knowledge for the sake of action. The classic example is ethics and or politics. Okay, so that's our classical background. How about a brief modern background? This is to go very, very fast and to draw wild overgeneralizations, but pardon me. So typically philosophy, modern philosophy is identified typically as either English or continental in the modern tradition. So like Enlightenment thinkers kind of date from Descartes on the continent or from Hume on the English or British Isles. And with both of these, we can find certain common veins or points of fruitful comparison. So both men reconceive inquiry in light of the perceived failure of Aristotelian sciences. So it seems to have been the case that this demonstrative notion, this classical notion, has not proved very efficacious. Man seems to have labored under the weight of a dark, dark age for nearly seven centuries. And now we throw off the perceived oppression and shackles associated with that system and proceed according to a different paradigm. And a lot of it is taken up with epistemology and with rational probity, okay, so like a discipline called criteriology, all of which is just to say that now a principal preoccupation of philosophy is how do we know that we know? So recall when I said St. Thomas Aquinas begins the first way with motion is evident to the senses, right? So for him, that's just commonsensical, and to deny that would betray a kind of insanity on the part of the inquirer. So in a certain sense, he's unconcerned with that argument because it strikes him as something that actually is defeating of inquiry, right? It is to decapitate oneself. Whereas what we find in modern philosophy is a big time, investment in, or at least concern with, epistemology. So on the one hand, you know, you have rationalism, which proceeds by a kind of methodological doubt. So Descartes calls everything into question except the structure of his own thinking and begins to build up reality from what he discovers intramentally. And then you have empiricism associated with Hume and his descendants, right? And there you begin with a kind of methodological skepticism. So whereas ordinarily I would say, like, I push this thing and it moves, Hume will say things like you can't actually establish a causal relation. We have associated ideas and we have a mental concept or a mental structure whereby to process that engagement, but we can't say that I caused it, because that's to go too fast and too loose, because such a thing is not actually supplied by sensation. Summary points about modern philosophy. One thing is natures and causes are narrowed in scope. So we do not entertain notions that are not available to sense impressions or to what Descartes called like les idées claires, like clear and distinct ideas, all right, in a basic sense. So that is ruled out to core, and as a result of which we need to build from something that is more criteriologically sound in their estimation. All right? And as a result of which you bracket formal and final causality. So usually in the classic Aristotelian picture, not only do you consider like the stuff, like what is the stuff, and the shape of the stuff or the form of the stuff, but you also have a sense of where the stuff is going, and you also have a sense of, not only do you consider the stuff and then what's moving the stuff, but you consider the shape of the stuff and then where the stuff is going, right? So you consider a formal cause, what makes a thing to be what it is, and you consider a final cause, that towards which it is ordered or inclined, not necessarily as a mental or conscious state, but like gravity, for instance, is something that would ordinarily be described in these terms. So yes, these things are set aside. Second, what you have is a mechanistic concept of nature, all right? So the notion of what is material is just reduced to extension. So to explain a corporeal thing now is to explain the parts and the relations that obtain among the parts. And then the third and final is a standard of mastery. So typically modern sciences reject or resist, at the very least, the distinction between speculative and practical, and rather it projects its findings in terms of what is useful or util. An example here, you can think of research grants. I don't know how many of you have gotten money to study something because you thought it was awesome, right? Usually, you have to be able to report back to your PI and to the grant giver that you have done something for humanity, something that is measurable, and something that at least has a hope for improving the human condition in some materially verifiable way. Now, a last point on the philosophy of science is, where then does science, modern science, overstep its bounds? Where does it make bad methodological moves? I think we can identify two. One is materialistic reductionism, and the second is scientism. So it's perfectly legitimate to bracket formal and final causality as a kind of methodological thing, right? But bracketing soon becomes denying, and then denying soon becomes a kind of tacit first philosophy. So it becomes an unstated presupposition of a lot of sciences that to even entertain final causality is silly, naive, childish, to be lampooned, okay? And you can think of like Molière's description in Tartuffe of the dormative power, right? That such a thing is the kind of thing that causes sleep. For him, it's nonsensical, it's insane, it's to be dismissed. What we often find is that scientists will metaphysically overinterpret the findings of science because of this tacit first philosophy. So the periodic table just comes to mean atomic reductionism, okay? So like even though we don't see a lot of these things in the wild, and truth be told, many of them exist in like momentary and very unstable states, we have it in our mind that these are the building blocks. When truth be told, a more classical conception is like you and I are building blocks, right? Trees are building blocks. Spike, you know, the Stegosaurus in The Land Before Time, he is a building block, okay? So a periodic table just means atomic reductionism. Another example would be evolution just means that all things are by chance, and the notion of chance is usually just eviscerated. Or like social conditioning just means that we don't have free will. I would submit to you that those things are overinterpreted or falsely interpreted claims that are made by scientists who have a kind of tacit first philosophy that admits of greater scrutiny. And then scientism is just to say, scientism is a kind of epistemological question begging. So you say the only thing that matters for our point is just force and stuff. And then other people try to claim that there are other things that matter, and you say that they don't matter because we had already decided that the only things that matter are force and stuff. Okay? Scientism, again, this is not especially charitable, and it's kind of rough and ready, but the claim is that only science yields genuine knowledge, right? And it's typically results-based. So an objection that you'll often hear is like, yeah, show me the progress from the Aristotelian scientific paradigm, and then show me the progress downstream of the industrial and scientific revolution. Like, which would you have? Like, do you want like 18 of your teeth to have cavities in them right now? It's like, no, I don't, okay? But that's a that's a fallacy of accident. Moving on, okay. So third and final point, a philosophy of faith. So here we're talking about a philosophy of theology, as it were, or philosophy of mysticism. Again, we're just interrogating the experience of those who have the disposition, who have the virtue, which admits of engaging with things revealed, okay? So philosophical tenets. Faith-based discourse is knowledge based on testimony. We have natural kind of ways by which to explain this. So, for instance, I've never been, where have I never been? I've never been to Miami, okay? But I trust that Miami is where the cartographer says it is in South Florida, because were he to put it someplace else, then he would not be very long employed as a cartographer, okay? So it seems to be the case that I can rely on testimony for certain things, and I have reasons whereby to adhere. Now, supernaturally, this obtains with respect to God and the things of God, okay? So the notion is that God makes himself known, and as a result of which I can have sure, certain knowledge, a certainty that actually exceeds the certainty of science by virtue of the fact that the testator is more to be relied upon than our fallible senses. That will sound irrational. We'll unpack it. Okay. The certainty in a faith claim hinges on the testator. I don't know if you have proof that your parents are your parents, right? But I think most of us find them reliable in this regard. You know, we don't say like, prove it, you know, until such time as you do, I will never hug you. Okay. All right. So the certainty hinges on the testator. All right. And then a kind of quick philosophical or scholastic distinction taken from St. Augustine and adopted by St. Thomas Aquinas, just to identify there are three dimensions at work in faith that are classically conceived. He lists them as credere Deum, credere Deo, and credere in Deum. And that just means to say to believe God, to believe in God, and to believe in a certain sense unto God. So there's a personalistic dimension to faith, okay? We believe God because truth himself speaks truly. Else there is nothing true. So he has shown himself to be trustworthy, and as a result of which we invest in a relationship. There is also a propositional notion to this faith claim. Okay, so credere Deo, to believe in God. I believe what he says. So it's a content-rich relationship. It places claims on one's life. And then third and finally, there's an effective dimension. So St. Thomas will read this last, credere in Deum, as pertaining to the will. It's something into which we lean. So faith fructifies in hope and charity. That is to say, it is to be born out in these kind of tethers of affection, not in the base sense of emotion, but in the sense of heart inclining unto heart. Okay? A basic definition of faith. St. Thomas says, faith is a habit of mind whereby eternal life is begun in us, making the intellect assent to what is non-apparent. You can think here of the definition in the letter to the Hebrews. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. Another classic definition is one given by St. Augustine. Faith is to think with assent. Summary points then about a kind of philosophy of faith. One, faith, or the claim made or advanced, is that man is capax revelationis, that we are actually capable of receiving revelation. Classically, this is described as an obediential potency. It's something that's not really in our nature in the strict sense, but it is not repugnant to our nature. And as a result of which, when it comes, as if unbidden, it finds in there a welcome home, okay? So another way that St. Thomas will describe obediential potency is with respect to miracles. He'll say that water doesn't have any natural potency to become wine, but by virtue of the fact that it admits of the change, it has an obediential potency to become so when Christ acts upon it. That sounds confusing, but basically what we're saying is that grace perfects and does not destroy nature. It makes it to be further realized by healing it, in the kind of Augustinian tradition and elevating it in the Thomistic tradition. So once, well, I'll just move on from that. First, manus capax revelationis. Two, homo religiosus, okay? That is to say that humans are naturally religious. This sounds bizarre, but St. Thomas will give it an excellent defense. We stand in a kind of cosmic relationship of indebtedness. So we are born into a network of relationships. We are by nature familial animals, social animals, and political animals. We can't divest ourselves of those things. There's no state antecedent to the state whereby we live as noble savages, okay? Rather, we are always and everywhere related. And part of that being related is being related to our origin and end, says St. Thomas Aquinas, which we can actually acknowledge by reason. We can reason from the fact of our contingent existence to a necessary one, and as a result of which we owe it some form, he says, of obsequies, is the word that he uses, or worship, right? We need to have this cosmic state reflected adequately in our interior life, or we'll always be in rebellion against what is and what obtains. So how we do this, he says, is by the virtue of religion, which is to say that we owe God a debt. So we owe him a kind of worship in light of the fact that he has given us everything. And then third and finally, it is reasonable to believe. That's the third and final philosophical tenet of this faith philosophy here. It is reasonable to believe. You might just ask yourself, what percentage of my knowledge is verifiable? I would submit to you that it's very small, okay? Whether by virtue of distance, relative size, instruments requisite for verifying our competence to actually practice such a thing, or our expertise, very little of what we know, we actually know, in the strict sense of science, or scientia in the classical way. Rather, a lot of it we take on testimony. I have never operated a scanning electron microscope, but my biology textbook is just punctuated by sweet pictures supplied thereby. And I look and I say, yes, I assent, okay? Because I trust that this biology textbook would not have many additions were they to propagate false things, okay? I know in like an age of fake news, a lot of this is kind of being eroded, but alas, all right, I'll still make the claim. I am just naive enough to stand up here with assurance. So the last point for this third and final is, where then does faith overstep? Where does it make bad methodological moves, which actually undermines its credibility in the public square? I'll list four. First, obscurantism and anti-liberalism. General notions abroad that church or ecclesial bodies are opposed to progress, cf. Crusades, cf. Inquisition, cf. Galileo, okay? Or that the church is prone to pronounce on issues that don't pertain to the substance of faith, all right? A kind of general skepticism towards scientific advance makes the church react and say things that are beyond its ken. This has happened. Part of being historical is just knowing when things have been done poorly, acknowledging them, but not permitting that to hamstring further efforts at discourse. Second, metaphysical naivete. So you've heard of the God of the Gaps argument, right? The notion being that God is often used to explain things that science has not yet discovered or found the way by which to explain. And so religionists will often launch in there and say, this must be God. But as science progresses, those gaps get smaller and God is forced out of the conversation. But I would submit to you that often that is a result of looking for God according to this paradigm of force and stuff. God answers to different questions, and I think religionists need to be mindful of that and to deploy a philosophy of both religion and science that accords with that vision. Third, fundamentalism, which is a kind of exegetical tradition, a way of reading the scriptures that is overly literalistic. So the scriptures have a literal sense, but they are not to be read literalistically. So they are to be read attentive to the genre in which things are being stated. So, for instance, Genesis 1 through 11 has, within the Christian tradition, often been read allegorically. A word used that people have an allergic reaction to is myth, but I think that's fine, okay, because myths are used to propagate truths according to a certain standard of truth, which is namely kind of anthropological and religious truths, all right? So Genesis is not describing, necessarily, a six-day creation. St. Augustine, who lived from 354 to 430, acknowledged this. Rather, he says, if it were the case that the sun were created on the fourth day, then how would one measure the time of the first 3 days, right? So he saw this, he admitted it, and as a result of which he was able to engage with the scriptures in a way that's far more rich and telling. He has two texts on Genesis, which I would recommend heartily. Fourth and finally, fideism. Fideism is a kind of philosophical stance whereby one just rejects the deliverances of reason. Okay, a classic example cited to this effect is the words of Tertullian. What hath Athens to do with Jerusalem? What can reason possibly do to inform my faith? All right, and this can come from a variety of quarters, but certainly for religious traditions which have a notion of radical depravity, right, that we have nothing good of our own except what grace can scrap from this rubbish heap, right, have a difficult time explaining the vigor, right, and the vibrancy of the contribution of human reason. But that's something to which we want to cling. That's something that we want to salvage. Okay, I realized I've talked quickly. Small conclusion. So does science discredit faith? You must be shocked to find that the answer is no. Rather, I contend that faith and science are compatible, right? And that with a notion of truth, which has our minds conformed to reality, we need never fear that disciplines which are actually ordered to what is will genuinely conflict, because all truth, says Hans Urs von Balthasar, is symphonic. Faith and science are two modes of discerning the one truth. The supposed incompatibility comes as a result of methodological error or overstepping of the stripes that we have just described. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to field your questions. Please.
So early on you mentioned that science functions through a kind of method, and the way that it survives and promulgates itself is by being useful according to this method, and that's the way that it works. You also mentioned at the beginning the notion of various philosophies having their own kind of eschatology, like Marxism having this notion that of the classes rising up. Would you say that there's also an aspect of that in scientism? As in not just, as scientism isn't just like saying science is the only thing that there is, but there's also this form, this thing that we put our scientific operations into in order to, that kind of tells us how we should dispose the world, how we should create, and not just like this methodology that we apply to little bits of it.
Sure. No, I think that's an excellent question. So I think, yes, there is an eschatology in the praxis of science, because science is practiced disparately. To make an overgeneralized claim would be dishonest and perhaps uncharitable to how it is practiced in a variety of quarters. But I think that so there is a standard of like amelioration of the human condition, and I think that a lot of scientists would say that we approach that asymptotically. So they have a general recognition just based on the data that we can't completely eradicate poverty. Right, we can't completely eradicate material need, but that we can operate on that as a kind of safe or sure principle, which will lead us in a generally good direction. So, I mean, by comparison to 40 years ago, like poverty throughout the world has been reduced by staggering figures. But then with that, in its wake have come other problems. So the scientist often feels like he is trying to operate on a variety of fronts to hold at bay all of these interrelated complex causal problems. But I think, so this is a related point from semiotics. So semiotics is the discipline of like language examination. And another big player, so Marx, Hegel, Freud is often included in that triad. Freud is of the mind that we name things by virtue of needs, okay? So in general semiotic theory, the reason that speech comes about is because we need something and we need to point to it, or often, because we want to name something, because the human mind is such that it likes to have the right names for things. But a kind of scientific reduction of that vision has often been to say that we just name for need. And I think you see that often kind of inscribed in a scientific theologic. So the only things for which we name, or the only things towards which we are inclined, is need and need satisfaction. And that what we're trying to do is eradicate need. But I think that because of the deadening of a spiritual dimension, we often generate problems that were formerly unbidden, and then we get caught in this process of creative redescription to say that it's actually not as bad. So, you know, like happiness studies, while they are, you know, even if they're longitudinal and epidemiological, they tend to be pretty wild and woolly. Like, how do people know that they're happy, and what is a common standard for evaluating happiness? But oftentimes it's educated and wealthy people who prove unhappy, okay? So people who are in indigence are unhappy. You give them just enough wealth so that they're no longer in indigence, and then they get happier. And then you continue to add wealth and they don't get happier. Actually, it's kind of tails off. it's like a strange logarithm that just crashes. So I think that that's a kind of large and sprawling way to say yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
You described faith as, like faith in God is more certain than trust in a parent because the testator, I can't remember the term, sorry, testator is more trustworthy. But it also seems like there's a distance between faith in God, that knowing that a particular revelation is from God versus knowing that something that we hear is from our parents.
Sure.
So does that difference in does that difference in distance somehow redress the balance of uncertainty? Because it seems like, on the face of it, you know, knowing that a particular, I don't know, scripture or, you know, a church or an individual is from God is actually harder than knowing that our parents are our parents, and therefore that seems to add some distance to the trust.
Sure. No, that's a great question. So I would say here we wanted to distinguish between a kind of theoretical claim and then a phenomenological claim, or as we experience it. So I think that there are grounds to trust God more than we trust our parents. And I think we can address it just from the perspective of distance. So oftentimes our conception, especially if we're operating within the ambit of a kind of materialistic or reductionistic notion of what is and what obtains, we tend to think of God as laid up in his heavens, as somehow distant from or alienated from our human condition. And as a result of which, it can be very easy to filter faith claims through that medium. But a classic theistic description of this has been to say that God is actually nearer to us than we are to ourselves. So for instance, in St. Thomas's Third Way, he draws out this distinction between essence and existence. So you, whatever we experience here could not have been. And from that, he reasons to something that need be, because nothing here has a sufficient explanation that it is. So a way that this is classically conceived in the 20th century philosophical tradition is, why is there something rather than nothing? And St. Thomas will say that we can always conceive of what a thing is apart from that it is. And as a result of which, we need to account for the fact that its thatness is conjoined to its whatness.
Sorry, just briefly, I think, yeah, I'm happy with faith in God's simplicity, but faith in a specific revelation of God seems harder.
Yeah, I will incorporate that. I will be direct against my better nature. The claim is that God is he who conjoins what is to that is. So everything that does not have existence by nature relies upon God to give it its existence, because God is subsisting existence. God exhausts all that there is of being. His very essence is to be, and as a result of which, he possesses being by right and shares it with all that is. And so God, so St. Thomas will describe God as omnipresent, namely that he is intimately present to all that is, as giving it his existence, in the case of us, as giving us our agency, as all things being transparent to his gaze. And so God is actually more present to us than we are to ourselves, and therefore than anyone else is. And so that is like the personalistic dimension in which these faith claims are then advanced, that I can rely upon the testimony of God as mediated through these other relationships. And that's the second point, is that God we speak of as principal cause, and then other agents that we encounter as secondary causes. So we're not divorcing the things taught to us by our parents from the things taught to us by God, because often God uses our parents to communicate to us the very things that he himself would have us know and love. And so when your parents raise you in the faith, and when your parents teach you the rudiments of, like a kind of ethical system, as it were, they are exercising a kind of secondary agency with respect to God, who possesses agency by right. So we can rely upon them as being embodied, as being already entangled in these networks of relationships, which mediate to us God's claims, which are propositional in content, because we have the type of mind which adheres to things said by virtue of what they say, you know, not just in light of the relationship that contextualizes it, but in actually in light of what is shared. Because if you had the type of friend who said, like, let's just be together, and there was never actually any substance or content to your relationship, it would be kind of, you know, febrile. It would be a bit anemic, right? So he gives us propositions whereby we can know, and as a result of which, love. So it's an extension of God's invitation to relationship rather than a kind of foreign or otherwise, you know, like human divorced potentate leveling claims just for the purpose of obedience. I hope that was pertinent. But if you have follow-up questions, I like the line.
That's plenty of food for thought. Thank you.
Okay. We have time for one more question. Yes.
So I actually was thinking kind of along similar lines. Like you said, you kind of gave the primary reason for believing in faith is this kind of trustworthiness of God, right? It's like God has shown himself to be trustworthy. So I guess it's like, well, like in what sense has God shown himself to be trustworthy? Because there are a lot of people, especially, you know, in today's society, who would deny God's trustworthiness or even his existence. So like what's the response to that?
Sure, that's an excellent question. So classically described, often we can speak of the use of reason within the ambit of faith. So to say that you believe is not to say that you, or it is not to say that you no longer reason, because now everything is a matter of testimony, but rather that reason like receives its full rigor and vigor, or is exercised according to its full rigor and vigor precisely within this context, because faith heals and elevates the exercise or use of reason. So four main ways in which we can kind of verify, as it were, though ultimately this is a faith claim, right? So we're not explaining away the faith, but we're bolstering the faith by showing that it corresponds. So the first is we can give consideration to faith claims and show their internal coherence. So we can interrogate the notion of the Most Holy Trinity and use the Aristotelian doctrine of subsisting relations as a way by which to show that what is one can also be three in a way that's not contradictory. Okay? So too, we can show how faith claims actually illumine the human condition. Like, if you're studying 19th century history and you study the Oneida community and you're like, wow, another utopian community. I bet you this one fails. How do you know that? You know that because as a believer, you have this deep conviction of original sin, and you know that everything that lays ready at hand will ultimately be poisoned by our efforts unless we are critical of them, right, and open to the prospect of some further revelation or guidance, okay? We can also know that as like an empirical claim because they all fail. Yeah, especially the ones that are like wife sharing. Great idea. You're like, oh my gosh. I give you guys like a month. Third is what is classically referred to as signs of credibility. So there are certain things about the church which testify to its veracity. Now, especially now in like post-2018, especially with like priestly and clerical scandals, this has been really shook. And we see that with church attendance. But we still want to propose what is often taught and what we can still adhere to. So think about this, okay? So a man receives 6 to 7 years of philosophical and theological formation, and then he has a kind of period of mentorship, right, where he's with an older priest after having himself been ordained, and then usually about 3 years later, he's made the CEO of a small corporation, okay? The fact that that institution is still here 2,000 years later, despite all attempts at mismanagement, is staggering, okay? I realize that's a kind of cynical way to put it, but like the endurance, the perdurance of the church, especially given the types of claims that it levels, which would ordinarily kind of cause a kind of disgust in its adherence. It seems to be life-giving and at the very least to command a certain, adherence. Another classic sign of credibility are miracles. The ones being most potent, those testified to of Jesus Christ himself. But you can see this in our own day, right? People continue to be healed up through and in the present, and especially medical professionals are often, they'll go to investigate a certain place that is associated maybe with an apparition of the Blessed Mother, like Lourdes, and they'll go as an atheist in order to disprove, and they'll come away a believer because they have no way by which to explain the phenomena that they themselves have observed, right? So there's something going on here. And then the fourth and final thing is what are referred to as preambula fidei, so the preambles of the faith. There are certain things that we can discover by reason which are also revealed, so there's an overlap period. So that God is, that he is simple, that he is perfect, that he is good, that he is eternal, that he is infinite. You know, just go questions 2 through 11. Those things are provable by reason, and as a result of which, it gives credence to the whole of the thing. Because that which is possible, like admits the possibility of discovery, well, it bears the scrutiny. So this is not to say that we can prove the faith. This is not to say that we can explain away mystery in any way, shape, or form. But it is to say that where it admits of rational scrutiny, it does hold up. So thank you so much for your attention, and I'm happy to hang up here and answer further questions. Cheers.